Thank you. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. This is our second of three oral hearings that we have this morning that we are considering for March 3. I'll just note for the record, this matter is file A21521 in the matter of the welfare of the children of JCL and JHL. Hopefully, then both of you can see the clock in one corner of your box that will be the normal time running. If at any time we have any technological issues such that we lose hearing you, the marshal knows to stop the clock and we wait till we're reconnected. We've had pretty good luck not having that issue for the most part, knock on wood. As usual, of course, Appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes, respondent's counsel 15 minutes as well, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. For all those who are listening in this proceeding, any reproduction is prohibited, recording of the proceeding pursuant to court rules, but the matter will be available online to listen again within 24 hours if you choose to do so. So we do ask counsel to identify yourself when you do begin your argument. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Carlson, and I represent the appellant mother in this matter, JCL. We are requesting that the Court of Appeals would reverse and remand the order transferring physical and legal custody of her four younger children to their step-grandfather. In preparing for today's argument, rereading the court's order a number of times, what stands out to me as the most concerning part of the order is the court's findings that the conditions that led to the removal have not been corrected. The court makes a finding that's a generalization about parents who struggle with chemical dependency and parents who struggle with mental health. Now, mental health in and of itself would not be a reason to terminate parental rights. The court has to look to the actual conduct of the parent in the matter of the welfare of kid. And in this case, mother's mental health did not manifest in any symptoms that endangered her children that were articulated by the court. The court made a finding that mother did not actively participate in attending therapy leading up to the trial. I'm concerned about what happened following the trial home visit and leading to the trial that happened on June 8th, and the lack of record or lack of facts in the court's order related to what the agency did following the trial home visit and what conditions were not corrected by June 8th that would allow the children to be safely returned to the care of their mother. Mother, it was not in dispute that she had housing, and it was not in dispute that she had actually worked really hard with social services in completing a lot of elements of her case plan. However, once the trial home visit ended, it feels like everyone decided this is time to move to permanency in a different direction, and that the efforts ceased and we stopped looking at what the conditions were or what it was that we could do to assist mother in becoming better prepared to have the children return to her care. So attending therapy in and of itself is not, or lack of attending therapy does not endanger the children. Similarly,
Ms. Carlson, are you saying that she had housing at the time of the trial home visit or at the time of the trial?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm saying that she had housing for the year leading up to the trial. She had housing during the trial home visit, and homelessness was not an issue at the time of the trial home visit, nor was it an issue at the time of the trial. The court made a speculative finding based on mother's financial situation that she most likely would not be able to maintain her housing. I don't think it's appropriate to look at what you would speculate a person is able to afford going forward and say, well, their housing is unstable based on the fact, I mean, especially when the facts are she's been in her home for an entire year and she's been employed for a year and she's been working with the agency for several years. There was an unfortunately ill-executed trial home visit. That's not in dispute. But Mother stated at the trial something that really sticks with me, which is that a slow transition would have been very helpful for her. And the way I see this case is we were heading towards a termination of parental rights during the summer of, during the summer of 2019. Mother completes her case plan to the satisfaction of the agency, so much so that they withdraw their petition to terminate parental rights. I appreciate that. But then the transition following the withdrawal of that petition is simply take all four of your children and, you know, we wish you the best. It was a very quick transition that in a normal child protection case, or rather I should say in other child protection cases, the transition is you go from supervised visits to unsupervised visits to a trial home visit, and you give the parents support throughout that transition. You give them support every step of the way to make sure that they are going to be situated to have, in this case, four young children return to their care. So it isn't surprising to me that the way this was executed, which was rather quickly, and I understand the agency was looking at timelines, but
Ms. Carlson, can I clarify then, if I understand correctly, at least, and especially as to the conditions, the court's findings you believe are clearly erroneous, in other words, not supported by the record. Am I correct in that summation of the findings the court did make?
Thank you, Your Honor. I do find that many of the court's findings are either clearly erroneous factually or clearly erroneous in that they fail to conform to the statutes, the statute, and also that they are just insupported, specifically with regard to the conditions, that they're insupported by that specific finding or series of findings is insupported by sufficient evidence.
I want to follow up on, go ahead.
No, that's fine, Judge Stewart, you may do that.
I want to follow up because I'm looking at finding 113. Of the judge's order. And because you seem to be kind of addressing that summation of the findings, and it seems to be a key findings in the case. And in looking specifically at that, it's on page 27 of 36 of the court's order. What in that summation do you believe is either not supported by the record or is clearly erroneous? Because I think it does, I think it's a key provision in the order.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. The order states that Mother has not demonstrated a long-term period of sobriety since the case opened. That's not supported by the record in that following the trial home visit, there was no testing other than one request that she would give a hair follicle test. And at the time that they asked her to give a hair follicle test, it was already after they had filed the permanency petition. And I understand there was, at that point in time, it seemed perhaps on both sides of things that further efforts towards reunification was futile. But the court never made a finding that efforts towards reunification was futile. So looking at 113, we would disagree with the statement that she hasn't demonstrated a long-term period of sobriety since the case opened because my client was sober following the trial home visit. She insists that she was sober after her October 5th or thereabouts roughly relapse. But also if-
Why wouldn't she do a hair follicle test then? Because the agency's in the position that they, you know, have to protect the safety of the children. And in order to do that, they have to confirm that she is in fact sober. And apparently as other findings indicated, there were numerous times where she either gave a fake test or didn't do the test or didn't do the hair follicle test. So,
Your Honor, I appreciate that. And I would say that why didn't she drive more than an hour to give a hair follicle test after she had been told that the agency was moving towards permanency and that she had the impression that the agency was no longer working to reunify. It was an unfortunate choice, but her failure to provide a hair follicle test is not indicative of her use. It's not proof that she was using. It was something that in hindsight should have been done. And there was no evidence that she was using following the trial home visit. Her testimony was not that. And I also don't see how the agency continued to assist her in addressing her substance use other than to ask her to give a hair follicle test an hour away from her home. If the agency is concerned that she's driving without a license, which is one of the things that they brought up as a concern, her unlawful behavior of driving without a license, then the agency can't ask her to drive an hour or more than an hour away to give a hair follicle test. Can't ask her to violate one element of the case plan to comply with another. I don't feel that the evidence was sufficient to support a finding that the conditions had not been corrected. Specifically, mental health, I don't know what the mental health findings are that would say that the conditions haven't been corrected. And mother's failure to give a hair follicle test when it was asked one time leading up to the TPR trial is also not indicative of anything that was actually going on in June of 2020.
Could I ask you a question on that, Ms. Carlson? And I was, the finding I had been looking at was 72 and 73. And I'll give you a moment to look at that while you're retrieving it. If it does go to question Judge Hooten had just asked. So for instance, in 72, the court made the point that the plan apparently states that failure to provide a sample constitutes a failed test. And as such, the court presumes, mother was using controlled substance on or about April 7 based on her failure to cooperate. And even if this presumption did not apply, the court does not find mother's excuses to be valid. And then in 73, I think goes into more detail of really that summary conclusion or summary finding in 113. Isn't it, I guess what I'm struggling with a little bit, Ms. Carlson, is so much of the objection that the reason that your client believes they're clearly erroneous seems to go to credibility, which of course, we defer to the district court. And so that hair follicle seems to be just one of them. But then the next finding goes into some detail about the unsuccessful treatments. And when you bring all that together, doesn't the judge have the freedom and we give deference to an overall picture that she is still chemically dependent, and that seems to drive a lot of the other issues in the plan the court found she's not complying with in terms of stable living and the constancy that children need, that sort of a thing. Am I looking at it in the wrong way?
I understand what the court is seeing. Thank you. I understand what the court is seeing here. The court is citing to the dispositional order, which does not, it wasn't in the case plan that was provided to mother. The physical case plan that was provided to her does not state failure to provide a test constitutes as a positive test. If that's how the agency is going to conduct itself, and I understand that reasoning, it would seem that the parent should be given full disclosure and should be a part of the case planning process, signing the case plan and participating in the case plan in establishing, if you don't give us a hair follicle test when we request one and fail to make adequate efforts to provide a missed hair follicle test, then we're going to consider it a false positive.
Would it be true, though, just to clarify, and this kind of typical in criminal law where individuals as part of release conditions are supposed to submit to UAs, and there's always an argument, were they or were they not using at the time they failed to appear? But wouldn't, ignoring then the presumption, the court be free to either agree or find incredible the explanation that she gave and then tie that in with the previous unsuccessful treatments to come to a finding that she continues to be chemically dependent?
Your Honor, I'm arguing that the evidence is insufficient to support that finding. The court can make credibility determinations, and if chemical dependency is a concern that the agency had leading up to the trial, then the agency should have continued to assist mother in that matter, other than simply asking that she would drive an hour from her home to provide a hair follicle test.
Yeah, that would go then to the reasonable efforts.
Correct,
Your Honor.
Or lack
thereof that your client argues.
And we do argue that. We argue that the reasonable efforts also, the efforts ceased being reasonable after the trial home visit terminated. It's unclear what assistance was offered to mother, and reasonable efforts requires an exercise of due diligence to do everything possible to reunify the family. That is the case, whether it's a termination of parental rights or a transfer of physical and legal custody, as the agency is required to continue to provide assistance to get the children returned to the home. I, in this case, see that mother was under the impression that the agency had stopped working to assist her following the trial home visit. And maybe there was some disconnect between her and the social worker at that time, the social worker who also wasn't as assisting towards mother during the trial home visit as mother was asking her to be. I am asking that this court would reverse the transfer of physical and legal custody on the basis that mother substantially complied with the case plan, the conditions had been corrected, and may I finish my sentence?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. That the efforts made by the agency were not reasonable, and that the transfer of custody was not in the children's best interest. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And so, counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself, then you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is John Lauer, assistant Pine County attorney, and I represent the respondent in this case, Pine County Health and Human Services. The issue in this case is solely whether the district court made findings of fact that are sustained by the evidence in the record, and whether its conclusions of law are sustained by those findings of fact. The district court made an extensively detailed 36-page order considering the four factors it needs to analyze under Minnesota Statute 250C.517 for a transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. First, the court made findings about how the transfer was in the best interest of the children on pages 11 through 16 that focused specifically on the best interests of the children. The court analyzed the case using all of the factors that are listed in Minnesota Statute 260C.212 as is appropriate with a child protection proceeding. Second, the district court did find that the agency made reasonable efforts to reunify the children. The court made specific findings and concluded that the agency provided more than satisfactory efforts toward reunification. With regard to the third factor, the district court made specific findings that appellant did not substantially comply with multiple requirements of the case plans that were designed to correct the conditions leading to out-of-home placement. At the time of trial, the children had been in court-ordered out-of-home placement for 709 days. The agency worked with the appellant throughout that time to correct safety issues with regard to the children and to get her to a place where she could provide the care and safety the children needed. Still, appellant did not make sufficient progress to correct those conditions leading to out-of-home placement or provide a safe and stable environment for the children. The court's findings regarding this factor are found in pages 18 to 26, and they detail the appellant's struggles to maintain sobriety, as has already been discussed. It details her dishonesty with social workers about her sobriety, her failure to address the recommendations in her diagnostic assessment, and her struggle to maintain safe and stable housing for the children.
Mr. Lauer,
how do you respond to the appellant's argument, though, that the period of time we should be looking at is after her home visit when she had the relapse up until the time of trial? And that she was making progress during that time, and there's no showing after that relapse that she was using drugs, and that she was involved in outpatient treatment at the time of trial.
Sure. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I think that's the question. Okay. How do you respond to that? Because and that's the period of time we should be looking at here, that there is an improvement.
Sure. So, Your Honor, the district court did make findings specifically related to the housing issue that was discussed at the time of trial. I know that the appellant was apparently living with a boyfriend who had an extensive criminal history that was related to theft and controlled substances. After a background study, it was determined that the children could not be returned to that residence where that individual was residing. This was months prior to trial that this was learned. And 2 weeks before trial, mother allegedly ended that relationship, but then was at risk of losing the housing as a result. And regarding the sobriety, Your Honor, and the missed hair follicle test, the appellant was given a gas card. She was given multiple chances to get the test and was assisted with scheduling. The social worker had to communicate with the lab to get updates because the appellant was not communicating with the social worker at all about what was going on. I believe that the licensed alcohol and drug counselor had to learn from the social worker about the hair follicle test. And that was how she also learned about the missed test. So appellant was not making meaningful progress with maintaining sobriety, and the housing issue was very, tenuous. And that's, I think, reflected in the district court's findings as well.
Mr. Lauer, the appellant's brief, I think in the second and third parts, which I think relate to the third and fourth factors, you know, it makes some fairly focused arguments that certain findings in certain paragraphs of the district court's order are clearly erroneous. Your responsive brief was more general, but I'm wondering if you could speak to some of those specific issues that were identified, if you're able to do so here, and to tell us why those specific findings are not clearly erroneous.
Thanks, Your Honor. I'll need to pull up the brief, if I can find it, I'm sorry.
So, for example, if you look at page 20 of the appellant's brief, mm-hmm. there's specific references to findings 63, 64, 68, and 73, and then following, the next section has a similar format. But...
Okay, sure. I see what you're saying, Your Honor.
Maybe if you're not prepared to do so, maybe it's not practical to do so during your argument, but I just wanted to get the benefit of your... of your argument on those specific issues.
I apologize, Your Honor. I was not expecting that specifically. I just want to take a quick look and see if I can make a quick response. So, Your Honor, the district court did make findings that address all of those issues, and I don't think that they're clearly erroneous. We had testimony at trial from the licensed alcohol and drug counselor who testified about mother's progress, and it not only with regard to remaining sober, but also with regard to addressing the concerns that were in her diagnostic assessment, and it was clear that appellant was not making the progress that was necessary to actually correct the conditions that led to court-ordered out-of-home placement. I apologize. I am not prepared to be more specific with appellant's brief, and I probably should be, so I apologize for that.
Okay. It's okay. Thank you.
So,
can I ask broadly though, Mr. Lauer, just very broadly speaking, it seems that the one of the gists of appellant's argument is that at least as of the time of trial, the court had not identified, for instance, efforts the county had made or the conditions that had changed. And are you believing, I guess, then without any specifics, if we looked at the record, there would be specific facts and testimony was presented, let's say, in the early months of 2020, leading up to the trial, that would show the findings that the court ultimately did make, that the conditions had not changed?
Yes, Your Honor, I would submit that. And I just don't think that it's true that there weren't any findings in the order that that addressed the conditions at the time of trial specifically, because again, the court examined the hair follicle test issue. Of course, in the order, it indicates that testing could not be done for, I believe it was due to COVID issues at the time. So testing was not done, but then we did request that hair follicle test that would have shown us whether or not appellant had been remaining sober, and she did not do so. The court, again, a missed test is a failed test, and that I know that that has been said at hearings. I can't speak to whether or not it was in the case plan that appellant got. I assume that it would have been. I don't have any reason to believe that it would not have been explained to appellant that a missed test was a failed test. And Your Honor, again, the district court made extensive findings that supported the transfer, that said that the transfer of custody would have been in the children's best interests. And I believe that all of those were effective at the time of trial as well. And again, I just want to emphasize the children had been in out-of-home placement at I think it was for a total of 709 days at the time of trial, because those conditions had not been remedied at the time of trial. We could not safely return the children to mother as or to appellant, as is always the preference. I hope that addressed that question, Your Honor.
It did. I assumed, and as it looks like as well, that that you believe and the court found the county continued to provide reasonable services all the way up to the trial, and that would include home visits and of course the testing requirement we already talked about and addressing issues of mental health. You're satisfied the record supports those findings by the court?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. Your Honor, I do want to address another issue from appellant's reply brief, actually, that indicated that the court did not make a specific finding related to the mother's relationship with the children. And I believe, Your Honor, after reviewing that argument, that that type of a finding is essentially an argument that the district court should have made findings about the parent-child relationship equivalent to those that it would have to make in a TPR case. But again, the required findings in TPR cases are not required findings in transfers of legal and physical custody cases. And the Minnesota Court of Appeals has already addressed that issue. I do have a citation to an unpublished case that I found after I read the reply brief in regarding the welfare of the child of MAD. It's an October 29th, 2018 case with Westlaw citation 5316233. So again, a finding like the one suggested in appellant's reply brief is simply not required in a transfer of legal and physical custody case.
Well, on that issue, would you agree we should look at section 260C.511?
I would, Your Honor, yes.
And paragraph B requires that the analysis should include a review of the relationship between the child and relatives and the child and other important persons with whom the child has resided or had significant contact, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the district court do that? And if so, where?
Thanks, Your Honor. I will pull up that order. It did make findings related to the child's relationships with current caretakers, parents, siblings, and relatives, and that is found on page 15. It's subparagraph I.
Okay, page 15 of the. Excuse me, it'll take me while I'm gonna find that, but I don't want you to wait for me.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I have one more question about that, if I may, and that is. You earlier made reference to the statute, section 260C.212. Mm-hmm. Isn't that statute, that section specifically for the purpose of determining the child's needs upon at the time of finding an out-of-home placement, finding an appropriate out-of-home placement? It seems like that's the purpose of .212, and I'm wondering how or why that would be relevant at a permanency trial where transfer of custody is the issue.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think that the district court used that, as I've seen used in other cases as well, because it needs to address the best interests of the children under 250C.517. It needs to address the best interests of the children, and that is a fairly detailed and extensive analysis under 260C.212. So I think the district court used that as a template and a guideline, so that it addressed multiple aspects of the best interests of the children, and that I think is why that was used. So Your Honor, I guess I'm running a little short on time here. I would be happy to answer any other questions. I do just want to end with reiterating that the district court did make extensive findings are supported in the conclusions of law. I'm sorry, Your Honor, the district court made conclusions of law that are supported in the findings of fact. And I believe that all of those are supported by evidence from the record. And I would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's order.
Any other questions either judge have? Very well, thank you, Mr. Lauer. And Ms. Carlson, you now will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am uncomfortable with the court's analysis regarding the best interest factors and the court's focus on 260C.212. The reason I'm uncomfortable is because I would agree that the correct statute to look to is 511. Or rather 260C 511, which includes a review of the relationships. And because the court's analysis with regard to the best interest factors is really a weighing that you would see that's similar to a custody determination, who's better situated, mother versus the grandfather. Well, they are not similarly situated, and they should not be stacked up against each other as though this is two parents, which when the court looks through these factors in 212 and says, the interests and preferences and the 10 factors in 212, I don't think it's fair to say the child's community, this, that, they all favor the grandfather. What the order actually has to explain, my read of the statute, is it has to say, why is a transfer of custody in the children's best interest? Not what 212 factors weigh in favor of the grandfather and which ones weigh in favor of the mother. Why is it that these children are served by a transfer of custody? Why is that necessary? Why does that serve them? And that isn't what I got from this court's findings. What I got was, if we are to stack up mother versus grandfather and to weigh the two of them as though they are two custodial parents, a number of factors would favor the grandfather and a couple of the factors would favor the mother. If you're going to make a determination, and I think that I addressed this in my principal brief, I do understand that the court has previously made determinations that the best interest factors, the parent maintaining the parent-child relationship, the child maintaining the parent-child relationship, and competing factors, there has been case law that supports both sides of that argument. I acknowledge that there has been case law that supports that the correct factors are in 212. I just think that that case law is incorrect. Or at least my read is that 212 is about placement and it is not the correct factors to address pursuant to 511 or 517. I'm sorry, Your Honor, please.
Would you agree, and I think this is the position of your opposing counsel, that the discussion by the district court at page 15, subparagraph I, that discussion there speaks directly to the factors mentioned in statute 511B. 511B, I think we would all agree, 511 defines and describes the best interest analysis for purposes of a transfer permanency trial, and it 511B refers to the relationships between the child and certain others. And Mr. Lauer has suggested that the district court in that one paragraph did analyze that issue. I know you're...
Could you refresh me as to where you are seeing this?
Mr. Lauer was pointing us to page 15 of the district court's order, 15 out of 36, and this is...
Thank you.
this is, I think paragraph I is the ninth factor in section 212. But I guess maybe the question is, I might agree with you that the district court improperly invoked section 212, but it may be that in doing so, perhaps coincidentally, in analyzing the ninth factor under 212, it happened upon the same concepts that are stated in section 511B. And if that's the case, then, you know, is it appropriate for us to review that discussion in subparagraph I, and would that suffice?
Well, it still doesn't reach the, I mean, there are, if I'm correct, the two things that I need to see is a review of the relationship with the mother, which to the extent that it's listed here is something that the children will still be able to see the mother. I don't know that that is an adequately complies with the statute, but I stand by my assertion that the other thing that has to be in a transfer of custody order is, how does the transfer of custody serve the children's best interests? And that is a, why are we making this legal determination? Not why is it that the grandfather is better than mother pursuant to the 212 factors? So I don't think that this paragraph, if I could answer your question, please.
Yes, you may finish, Ms. Carlson.
Thank you. I don't think that this paragraph is adequate for my reading of the statute. Just to make a simple statement that they'll be able to have, and it's hard for me to go through this paragraph and see something specifically related to the mother, because it's obviously it's a lengthy finding. I think that in the spirit of the law and in the children's best interests, any permanency proceeding, although the case law has gone both ways, any permanency proceeding should address both the parents' relationship or the parent's interest in maintaining the parent-child relationship, the child's interest in maintaining the parent-child relationship, and any competing interests. There is some case law that supports that. There is some case law that does not support that contention. But either way, the order has to establish why it is that a transfer of custody is in the children's best interest. And I would ask this court would reverse and remand, because the order does not establish why it is in the children's best interest that transfer of custody be to the grandfather. It simply establishes that the grandfather has a few arguments going his way and that mother has a few going hers.
Ms. Carlson, if I'm going to ask you one additional question in relation to that. And as you were talking, you referenced in your brief the TPR, the three best interest factors that the court needs to consider. Respondent believes the court was correct in using 212. We're now focusing on the transfer best interest. And you referenced that finding the court made, or and a conclusion really, that is the rights are not severed. And in fact, there would be a legal option for her, if I understand correctly, to seek modification of custody at such time that she feels ready, probably to address the issues that the court found. Might that be an explanation of why the type of best interest analysis, even in 511, distinguishes it from the TPR, and as you point out, distinguishes it from the 212? It's a different type of best interest, given there is no permanency to it. It's what's the situation now, what would be in their best interest, notwithstanding a parent-child relationship.
Your Honor, I very much appreciate having a chance to get a bit philosophical as to what the legislature's intent was when it comes to why 511 is different than 212. I believe that in this case, and perhaps the court is correct, as my side of the practice of law looks at what happens leading up until the permanency is established. And in leading up to when permanency is established, we treat an involuntary transfer of custody similarly to a termination of parental rights, in that it is a permanent decision. We don't assume that a parent is going to be able to make a change to the custody agreement at some point in the future, although I understand that that statute is not before me and is not before the court. Your Honor, you might be correct, and I although I cannot adequately answer your question right now, I promise you have given me a great deal of food for thought in looking at these statutes and how they relate to each other. And I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you all for your time this morning.
Very good. Any other questions either judge has? Very well. Thank you to both counsel.